Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. On a cold West Virginia morning, a woman vanished without a trace. She wasn't someone who simply walked away from her life. She had a family, routines, and people who expected to hear from her again. But in the blink of an eye, she was gone. Days turned into weeks, weeks turned into years. Rumors spread through the community, leads surfaced and faded. Questions multiplied, but answers never came. What happened during those final moments before Marcia Ferber disappeared? Was someone hiding the truth in plain sight? Or was the key to solving the mystery lost with time? The case we have for you today continues to haunt those who remember it. A case that reminds us that even in the quiet hills and close-knit communities of West Virginia, people can vanish and leave behind a trail of unanswered questions. This is the case of Marcia Ferber. Before we get into this case, there's something I want to say. From the very beginning, I knew this story had to be told differently. Because yes, this is the story of a woman who disappeared without a trace. It's a story filled with unanswered questions, conflicting timelines, rumors and theories that have persisted for nearly four decades. But if we only focused on the mystery of what happened to Marcia Ferber, I think we missed the most important part of this story. She was a mother, a friend, a business owner, someone who opened her doors to people who needed a place to belong. She gave musicians a stage, helped people when they had nowhere else to turn, and made the people around her feel welcomed and accepted.
And I think that's why so many people still talk about Marcia today. They're not just trying to figure out what happened to her, they're remembering who she was.
Exactly. So before we ask what happened to Marcia Ferber, let's take a moment to understand who she was, because I think that's where this story truly begins. For much of the 1980s, Marcia Ferber's bar, the Underground Railroad, and the Dry House were fixtures of Morgantown's underage youth and club scene. The club itself was electric, hosting everything from acoustic folk acts to full-blown 80s punk bands. And some of the artists who played there are names you'd probably recognize today. To those who knew her, Marcia Ferber was more than just a businesswoman. She was an unapologetic humanitarian with a deep love for children and the planet Earth. Hardly the type of person you'd expect to find at the center of a decades-old mystery. Sometime around April 25th, 1988, 47-year-old Marcia Ferber disappeared without a trace.
And Mark, before we even get into what happened to Marcia, I think it's important to understand just how well known she really was. Because this wasn't somebody who kept to herself.
No, not at all. Marcia seemed to know everyone, and everyone seemed to know Marcia. She had connections through the music scene, local businesses, activism, and the community itself. People genuinely cared about her, which is exactly why people noticed when she wasn't around. Marcia Ferber was born Marcia Bodine in Massachusetts on April 4th, 1941. For much of her early life, she lived what many people would consider a conventional life. She married, raised two children, and by the standards of the time, she was viewed as a typical housewife. But by the late 1960s, her life took what you could call a progressive turn. She aligned herself with anti-establishment movements, particularly those advocating for an end to the Vietnam War and the return to agrarian and communal living. Eventually, Marcia moved to Calhoun County, West Virginia, where she joined a local commune.
Which, can we both say, it honestly isn't something people associate with West Virginia.
No, and I didn't either until researching this case. But during the 1970s, West Virginia experienced something of a renaissance. Former residents returned home while outsiders arrived looking to escape urban and suburban life. There was this grassroots movement encouraging people to return to the land and reject commercialism and the concrete jungle. West Virginia turned out to be the perfect fit. Communes, farms, co-op organizations began popping up all over the state, and Marcia fit right into that lifestyle. But the 60s and 70s didn't last forever. The ideals didn't disappear completely, but they adapted with the times. When the commune eventually disbanded, Marcia moved to Morgantown. There she purchased the Earth House, a residential boarding house on College Avenue that catered mostly to local hippies and students. She also teamed up with her friend, Deborah Lynn Hamilton, to produce Loving for Food, a publication serving food co-ops throughout the upper and lower Ohio Valley. Then, in 1982, Marcia purchased the Underground Railroad, and that's really where her roots in Morgantown became firmly planted. For the next 5 years, the Underground Railroad kept rolling, offering food, drinks, and an electric lineup of live music. Artists ranged from blues legend Bo Diddley to punk icons the Dead Kennedys and even the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
You know, that absolutely blows my mind. Could you imagine telling somebody today that at one point the Red Hot Chili Peppers played in Morgantown?
Exactly. But despite all of the music and excitement, it wasn't always smooth sailing. Like many college towns, a large concentration of 20-somethings also meant a heavy concentration of drugs and illicit substances. Partying, loud music, and drinking may have been tolerated by the community, but harder drugs like cocaine, LSD, and speed? That was another story entirely. As attitudes in the region slowly shifted towards a less permissive mindset, people's opinions about establishments like the Underground Railroad began to cool. And according to many people around Morgantown, it wasn't exactly a secret that Marcia sold marijuana. There was allegations that she not only sold it, but she also imported it from New York City. Now, because of the nature of those activities, exact details are difficult to verify. But that belief had become part of Marcia's story.
And I think it's important to point out that people are complicated. You can acknowledge that someone may have made questionable choices while also recognizing the good that they did.
Exactly. Because whatever her vices may have been, Marcia earned a reputation as someone who genuinely cared about others, especially young people. People described her as generous and supportive. Some viewed what she did for the community as a form of service. On the surface, everything appeared to be going well. But in early 1988, friends started noticing changes. People who knew Marcia said she had always been very health conscious, yet suddenly she was eating foods she normally wouldn't touch. Processed foods, less than fresh foods. She also had started smoking, something she had not only avoided herself, but openly discouraged in others.
And when somebody suddenly changes habits they've had for years, people notice, especially close friends.
Exactly. Karen Zellermeyer, a friend of Marcia's Calhoun County days, and later the co-host of the podcast I Was Never There, noted that Marcia wasn't going out as much. She also became concerned that Marcia's growing association with members of a biker club that had been frequenting the Underground Railroad.
And I know we're going to talk more about them later, but hearing that definitely raises some red flags.
It does. And around that same time, Marcia's 5-year relationship with her boyfriend and business partner, Randy Williams, also appeared to be cooling off. There were signs that Marcia might simply be growing tired of Morgantown. In early 1988, the Dry House, a non-alcoholic, student-oriented establishment she opened in 1968, was struggling financially. Marcia had been trying to transform it into a legitimate youth center connected to a non-profit organization. Her attorney later confirmed that she'd been working on that project for quite some time and had even scheduled a meeting with a representative from Knoxville, Tennessee. At the same time, friends recalled Marcia talking about moving to Florida, opening a lounge, maybe even running a hotel. But then in mid-April, that apparent wanderlust seemed to fade, because suddenly, Marcia became interested in purchasing and restoring Morgantown's historic Metropolitan Theater, a project that likely would have kept her in Morgantown for years.
So which was it? Did she want to leave or did she want to stay?
In court, that's one of the biggest questions in this case, because depending on who you ask, Marcia was either preparing for an entirely new life somewhere else or investing in a future right there in Morgantown. And just days later, she would disappear. By the spring of 1988, the people closest to Marcia Ferber had started noticing something. She wasn't necessarily acting like herself. There were little changes. Nothing dramatic enough to make people think that she was in danger, but enough that years later, people still remembered them. Some friends thought she seemed distracted. Others thought she seemed tired. And some wondered if she was simply ready for a fresh start. Then came a trip to New York. Now, on the weekend of April 15th and 16th of 1988, Marcia traveled to New York City to visit her longtime friend, Karen Zellemeyer, and Karen's daughter, Jamie.
And if that name sounds familiar, it should, because Karen and Jamie would later go on to create the podcast, I Was Never There, which covered Marcia's case in incredible detail.
And honestly, if y'all haven't listened to it, you absolutely should. Every episode hooked me from the beginning. Karen knew Marcia from her days in Calhoun County. Jamie grew up around Marcia. This wasn't just another true crime story to them. This was personal. But investigators later learned that there may have been another reason for Marcia's trip to New York. According to information gathered during the investigation, Marcia allegedly used that trip to secure a large amount of marijuana that she intended to bring back to Morgantown to sell.
Which immediately complicates this case, because now you're introducing money, drugs, and people who may not exactly want to cooperate with the police.
Exactly, and unfortunately, that's something investigators would run into over and over again in this case. People knew things. People heard things. But whether they wanted to talk was another story entirely. Marcia returned to Morgantown on Thursday, April 20th. At least on the surface, life seemed to continue as normal, but within days, she vanished. Saturday, April 23rd, 1988. Sadly, we don't know much about Marcia's movements during the earlier part of Saturday. At some point that day, she spoke with her friend, Deborah Hamilton, on the phone. Do we know how long they talked? No. Do we know exactly what they discussed? No. And that's one of the frustrating parts of this case. There were moments that seemed incredibly important, but the details had been lost in time. Later that evening, around 10:30 p.m., Marcia met with her tenant, Jack Herbert. And I want to point something out here. Jack wasn't just renting from Marcia. Marcia was actually allowing him to live there rent-free.
Which sounds exactly like everything people said about her. She genuinely tried to help people.
She did. Jack told Marcia that he was planning to travel to New York the next day. He asked if she would be willing to watch over his booth at a local flea market while he was gone. Marcia agreed. Simple as that. A small favor between friends. But here's why it matters. People planning to disappear don't usually volunteer to cover someone's flea market booth the next day.
It's another future commitment, another indication that she expected to be around.
Exactly. After speaking with Jack, Marcia drove to nearby Purse Glove. There, she visited a friend, Dana Dalton, at the home Dana shared with her boyfriend. Dana would later tell investigators that Marcia simply wanted to get out of Morgantown for a while. Nothing seemed unusual, no signs of distress, no mention that she was afraid. no indication that there was anything wrong.
Did Dana mention whether Marcia talked about Florida, the theater, anything like that?
Not from what we know. And that's important because hindsight makes us want every conversation to mean something. But according to Dana, this appeared to be exactly what it looked like, a friend stopping by to visit. Marcia stayed there into the early morning hours, then she headed back to Morgantown. Sunday, April 24th, 1988. Around 3:30 that morning, Marcia returned to the building where she lived above the dry house. That's when she crossed paths with Randy Williams, her boyfriend and business partner, and by many accounts, someone she had been growing apart from. Randy later told investigators that they exchanged a few words outside. Nothing unusual, nothing concerning. There wasn't an argument, no dramatic confrontation. Nothing that made him think anything was wrong.
And this is one of the moments investigators really wanted to focus on. Because if Randy is telling the truth, then less than 24 hours before Marcia disappeared, she seemed perfectly normal.
Exactly. And by all accounts, that's what people kept saying. She seemed like Marcia. Later that day, she followed through on the promise she made Jack Herbert. She worked his flea market booth. Again, normal behavior, keeping commitments, and helping people. Doing exactly what she said she was going to do. There was nothing to suggest that in just 24 hours, she'd seemingly vanish. Then Sunday evening arrived, and another important figure entered the story, Gary Perkins.
And Gary becomes one of the most important people in this entire case. Because depending on what actually happened, he may have been the last person to see Marcia alive.
Gary had driven from Cleveland, Ohio to Morgantown. He later told investigators he'd come to bring Marcia information about possible business opportunities and properties in Florida. The drive itself would have taken roughly 3.5 hours. According to Gary, when he arrived in Morgantown, he went directly to Marcia's apartment above the dry house. The two spent the evening talking. They discussed Florida. They talked about Marcia's interest in opening a business there. But they also talked about something else, the Metropolitan Theater.
Which takes us right back to that contradiction. Does she want to leave West Virginia, or is she planning to invest in Morgantown?
Even in the final days, Marcia seems torn between two very different futures. According to Gary, he spent the night sleeping on Marcia's couch. And as Sunday came to an end, there was nothing to suggest that anyone was witnessing the final hours of Marcia Ferber's known life. But Monday morning, everything would change. Because on April 25th, 1988, Marcia Ferber would leave the Underground Railroad with Gary Perkins. And after that, the timeline becomes one of the most debated aspects of this entire case.
And from this point forward, almost every answer seems to come with another question.
And unfortunately, Court, that's exactly where this mystery begins.
Hey everyone, I'm Alex, and I'm from APAW Unsolved in West Virginia. I'm a missing persons advocate with a background in criminal justice and psychology, and this channel was created to bring attention to the missing and murdered cases that deserve to be remembered. Here we talk about real people, real families, real stories that still need answers. I spend time researching these cases, speaking with families, and sharing the stories of victims from West Virginia and surrounding areas in hopes of bringing more awareness to cases that are often forgotten. Some of these families have spent years searching for answers. Some are still waiting for someone to come forward, and sometimes all it takes is one person hearing a story to make a difference. If you care about true crime, advocacy, and helping keep these cases in the public eye, make sure to subscribe to APAW Unsolved in West Virginia on YouTube and follow me on Facebook. Together, we can help make sure these stories are never forgotten.
By the time Monday morning rolled around, nobody around Marcia Ferber had any reason to believe they were witnessing the final known hours of her life. As far as anyone knew, it was just another day, business as usual. But looking back now, every detail from that day dissected over and over again, because somewhere between Morgantown and Pittsburgh, Marcia Ferber disappeared. According to Gary Perkins, he woke up Monday morning after spending the night on Marcia's couch. The two went to breakfast at the Blue Ribbon Restaurant, which was located next to the Underground Railroad. After breakfast, Gary said they went into the Underground Railroad and spent some time in Marcia's office. He recalled that several other people were there.
So right away, Gary's account isn't happening in isolation. There are people around them, people who could potentially verify parts of what he's saying.
Yeah, and one of those people was Michelle Wolford. Michelle was the general manager of the Underground Railroad, and her recollection of that morning became incredibly important to investigators. Michelle later said she spent time with Marcia in the office that day and confirmed that Gary was there with her. According to Michelle, Marcia told her that she was taking the rest of the afternoon off. She said she expected to be back in Morgantown around 6 o'clock that evening, and after that, she planned on visiting friends.
Again, that's another future plan. She's telling people, I'll be back later. She's making plans for that night.
Exactly. Nothing about that statement suggests someone preparing to disappear. Nothing about that statement suggests someone preparing to disappear. If anything, it sounds like someone with a full schedule. Michelle also provided investigators with one of the most detailed descriptions of Marcia's appearance that day. She remembered Marcia wearing a long white men's shirt that had been hand-painted. The shirt had red, yellow, and blue designs on it. She was wearing either black or blue jeans and white sneakers. And according to Michelle, the only thing Marcia carried with her was a simple day pack.
No suitcase, no overnight bag, nothing that screams, I'm leaving town.
Exactly. No luggage, no indication she planned on being gone for days. At some point between noon and 1:30 p.m., Marcia and Gary left the Underground Railroad together. And according to everyone who saw them, nothing seemed unusual. No arguments, no visible fear. No indication that this would be the last confirmed day anyone would see Marcia. Now this is where things start getting complicated. According to Gary Perkins, after leaving the Underground Railroad, the two drove south to Marjorie Gardens. Marjorie Gardens was a public housing complex located 2 miles from downtown Morgantown. Under normal circumstances, the drive would have taken maybe 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay. So why did they go there?
That's the million-dollar question, because nobody seems to know for sure. Gary never provided a clear explanation. Investigators tried to piece it together later. Michelle had previously mentioned that one of Marcia's close friends, Shauna Jennings, lived there. Others suggested that Marcia may have been visiting someone named Becky Payne. But investigators were never able to definitively establish who Martha was meeting, if she was meeting with anyone at all.
And that's frustrating because this could have been one of the most important stops of the entire day.
You're right. If Marcia met someone there, that person could potentially hold the key to this entire case. But nearly 4 decades later, we still don't know why she went there or who she may have seen. According to Gary, after leaving Marjorie Garden, the two headed towards Pennsylvania. Their destination? The Four Point Sheraton Hotel, located near Pittsburgh in what reports variously listed as Mars or Warrendale, Pennsylvania. Under ideal driving conditions, the trip from Morgantown to the hotel would have taken about an hour and a half.
And this isn't just Gary saying they were there. Investigators actually confirmed this part?
They did. The manager of the hotel later recalled a couple matching Gary and Marcia's general descriptions dining in the hotel's restaurant that afternoon. And then investigators found something even better, a receipt, an actual paper trail, One person ordered a New York strip, the other ordered chicken parmesan. Wine was ordered. The total bill came exactly to $75.01.
Okay, so I know this is going to sound strange, but details like this always hit me. Because suddenly this isn't some abstract mystery anymore. You can almost picture it. Two people sitting in a restaurant, eating lunch, ordering wine, completely unaware that one of them is about to disappear.
Exactly. Those tiny details humanize these cases. Because Marcia wasn't just a missing persons report. She was a real person having probably what felt like a completely ordinary meal. And then came one of the most important witnesses in this case. Their waiter, James Terwilliger. He later told investigators that he remembered serving the couple. According to him, Gary appeared spaced out. And Marcia? Marcia seemed tired.
Do we know exactly what he meant by tired? Upset? Exhausted? Distracted?
Unfortunately, no. And that's another frustrating part of this case. Tired can mean 100 different things. Maybe she hadn't slept much. Maybe she was stressed. Maybe it meant absolutely nothing. But because this became the last confirmed sighting of Marcia Ferber, people have spent decades trying to assign meanings to every word. The waiter also recalled that they remained at the restaurant from approximately 3:27 p.m. to 4:58 p.m.
And that's huge because now we have an actual timeline, not just someone's memory.
Exactly. A receipt, a witness, a documented time frame. As of 4:58 p.m. on Monday, April 25th, 1988, we know Marcia Ferber was alive. We know where she was, and we know who she was with. What happened after that depends on entirely who you believe.
Because this is where Gary says they drove back to Morgantown.
Gary maintained that after leaving the Sheraton, they headed back towards West Virginia. He said they stopped for gas along Beechhurst Avenue. Then he dropped Marcia off at the Underground Railroad sometime between 6:30 and 7 p.m. In court, that's where things started falling apart. Because investigators could never independently verify that Marcia actually made it back to Morgantown. No witnesses, no phone calls, no confirmed sightings, nothing. Which means the last confirmed sighting of Marcia Ferber wasn't in Morgantown at all. It may have been inside a Pennsylvania hotel restaurant at exactly 4:58 p.m.
And honestly, that's chilling because if that's true, nobody knows where Marcia spent the final moments of her life.
And for 38 years, that's the question investigators, friends, and family have been trying to answer. What happened between Pittsburgh and home? Marcia's friends realize something is terribly wrong. A missing persons report is finally filed, and investigators begin unraveling a case that only seems to get more complicated with every lead they chase. If Gary Perkins' account is accurate, he dropped Marcia Ferber off at the Underground Railroad between 6:30 p.m. and 7 p.m. on Monday, April 25th, 1988. And if that's true, nobody who truly knew Marcia ever saw her again. Now, at first, nobody panicked, because disappearing for a few days wasn't completely out of character for Marcia. She was spontaneous, independent, the kind of person who might decide to take off on an unexpected trip. But as days passed, that explanation became harder and harder to believe. On Tuesday, April 26th, Jack Herbert returned to Morgantown from New York. When he got back, he realized Marcia wasn't home. At first, he wasn't alarmed. Like I said, according to people who knew her, Marcia occasionally took spur-of-the-moment trips. So Jack figured she'd turn up eventually.
And honestly, if that's someone's personality, you don't immediately jump to the worst case scenario.
Exactly. You tell yourself there's a perfectly reasonable explanation. Maybe she went to visit someone. Maybe she had business to take care of. Maybe she just wanted to get away for a few days. You don't immediately assume something terrible has happened. But then Thursday came. Still no Marcia. No phone call. No messages. No one had heard from her. And that's when people started getting worried. Jack reached out to Michelle Wolford. Michelle hadn't seen Marcia since Monday afternoon. Other friends were contacted. No one had heard from her. No one had seen her. In court, this next part is important because it really highlights the environment surrounding this case. Many people in Marcia's social circle had varying degrees of involvement with drugs, whether that meant using them, selling them, or simply associate with people who did. Because of that, there was a natural hesitation to involve law enforcement.
Because the minute police start asking questions, everyone's worried about what might come back on them.
You're so right. Even if your only concern is protecting yourself, that fear can delay an investigation. And unfortunately, time matters in missing persons cases. But eventually, Marcia's friends decided their fears didn't matter. Finding Marcia mattered. On Sunday, May 1st, 1988, 6 days after Marcia Ferber was last seen, Jack Herbert contacted the Morgantown Police Department and filed a missing persons report.
6 days. And listening to that now, it sounds like a long time. But given the circumstances, you can understand why it happened.
I think you can, because nobody wanted to believe that Marcia, of all people, had simply vanished. They thought she would just walk back through the door, that she'd call, that she would explain where she had been. Instead, the missing persons investigation officially began. In court, we've actually seen the original report. And I think hearing those words almost takes you back to that moment. Would you mind reading it?
Sure. Quote, "The complainant states that his housemate, listed as suspect number one, space, has not been seen or heard from since Monday. Miss Ferber's vehicle has been parked on the upper level of the Pleasant Street parking garage since Monday. Miss Ferber is the owner of the Underground Railroad. She has left before, but usually calls and lets someone know where she is. According to the complainant, Miss Ferber usually takes her vehicle when she leaves. The complainant believes that Miss Ferber is or has been subject to some type of danger due to the fact she has not contacted him or any of her friends," end quote.
And honestly, that last sentence gives me chills. Subject to some type of danger. Because in 6 days, the people who knew Marcia best already knew something wasn't right. This wasn't normal. This wasn't Marcia.
And I think what stands out to me is the mention of her car. Because if she normally took it with her, why was it still there?
My thoughts exactly. It's one of the first red flags investigators encountered. Marcia's car was exactly where people expected it to be if she had planned on coming home. Not disappearing, no luggage was missing, no goodbye notes. No indication she'd intentionally walked away from her life. Instead, the picture emerging was of a woman who had every intention of returning and never did. Just 2 days after the report was filed, investigators began digging deeper. The case landed in the hands of detectives R.L. Boyce and J.R. Downs. While they interviewed people close to Marcia, other detectives began examining the evidence they had. And at that point, they had very little. No crime scene, no body, no witnesses to violence. Only a woman who seemed to have vanished into thin air.
And unfortunately, that's what makes these cases so difficult, because you don't even know where to start.
You're right. Do you investigate it as a voluntary disappearance? An accident? A homicide? At that point, everything was still on the table, but the more investigators spoke with the people closest to Marcia, the stranger this case became, because everyone had pieces of the puzzle. Nobody had the whole picture, and some of those pieces didn't fit together. When we come back, detectives speak with Michelle Wolford, re-examine Gary Perkins' story, and begin chasing witness sightings that would only make the mystery of Marcia Ferber even more confusing.
Because just when investigators thought they had a timeline, people started saying they seen Marcia after she had already disappeared.
And that's where this case takes another turn.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
After Marcia Ferber was officially reported missing, investigators got to work. And almost immediately, they realized this wasn't going to be a straightforward case. Because the more people they interviewed, the more confusing the timeline became. 2 days after the missing persons report was filed, detectives began conducting formal interviews with the people closest to Marcia. One of the first people they spoke with was Michelle Wolford.
Which makes sense. Michelle had worked closely with Marcia and was one of the last people who could confirm seeing her.
Exactly. Michelle had been with Marcia inside the Underground Railroad on Monday, April 25th. She had watched Marcia and Gary Perkins leave together, and she had one of the clearest recollections of Marcia's appearance that day. Court, I actually did have Michelle's original statement. Do you mind to read it?
Sure. Quote, I last seen Marcia Ferber between 1 and 1:30 p.m. Monday, April 25th, in the office of the Underground Railroad, 123 Pleasant Street. She was preparing to leave with a friend for Cleveland, Gary Perkins, and asked if she could take the rest of the afternoon off. She would go see a friend who was visiting town. Marcia was wearing a long white men's shirt, hand-painted in red, yellow, and blue jeans, and white sneakers. I don't remember whether they were blue or black jeans. I have not seen or heard from her since then, end quote.
Michelle's statement reinforced what investigators already suspected. Marcia wasn't packing up and leaving town. She wasn't saying goodbye. She wasn't acting like someone preparing to disappear. She was taking an afternoon off. She planned to come back. She planned to visit friends later that evening. It sounded ordinary, and that's exactly what made it so unsettling.
Because if she really intended to come back, then something happened.
Exactly. The question was, what? That same day, Detective Boyce spoke with Gary Perkins over the phone. Gary said that he had traveled from Cleveland to Morgantown on Sunday, April 24th, to bring Marcia information about possible business opportunities in Florida. Then he added something investigators hadn't previously known. According to Gary, before heading out to Pittsburgh, he and Marcia had stopped at Marjorie Gardens.
Which immediately raises that question again. Who were they seeing?
I wish I knew. Gary said they stopped there before eventually driving to the Four Point Sheraton near Pittsburgh. He also repeated his claim that after returning from Pennsylvania, he dropped Marcia off at the Underground Railroad between 6:30 and 7 p.m. Then he returned home to Cleveland.
And investigators couldn't verify any of that once they got back to Morgantown.
No, they couldn't find they couldn't find anyone independently. They couldn't find anyone who independently remembered seeing Marsha after Pittsburgh. And that was a problem. But investigators kept digging. They checked local hospitals. Nothing. Taxi companies. Nothing. Bus lines. Nothing. Limousine services. Nothing. It was as if Marsha had simply disappeared. Then just before the end of the night, of what had already been a long day, Detective Boyce received a phone call. At around 10:40 p.m., Deborah Hamilton contacted him with what she believed could be crucial information. According to Deborah, a woman named Barbara Mokas had told her she had seen Marsha, but not on April 25th, but days later.
Wait, so now we're talking about sightings after Marsha supposedly disappeared.
Exactly, and that's where things start getting messy. Barbara reportedly told Deborah that she had seen Marsha on Saturday, April 30th, 5 days after she was last seen leaving for Pittsburgh. But that wasn't all. Deborah also said two other people claimed that they had seen Marsha on Friday, April 29th, and according to them, she wasn't alone. The witnesses said that Marsha had been seen in the company of a man named Glenn Moore. The two were reportedly riding around in Marjorie Gardens in a gray Pontiac Trans Am.
So, investigators are trying to determine whether Marsha is missing, dead, or voluntarily gone. And suddenly, people are saying, oh yeah, we saw her.
I mean, yeah. Imagine being the detective assigned to this case. You think you have a timeline. Then suddenly, witnesses start pushing that timeline days into the future. Was Marsha really alive on April 29th and 30th? Were these mistaken sightings? Was someone intentionally misleading investigators? Nobody knew. Detectives later spoke with Glenn Moore himself. According to Glenn, Marsha had told him she had planned to be at the Pittsburgh airport around 2 p.m. on Monday, April 25th.
Which doesn't exactly line up with lunch at the Sheraton from 3:27 p.m. until 4:58 p.m.
No, it doesn't. And that's another contradiction investigators had to deal with. One more piece of the puzzle that refused to fit together. Investigators eventually determined that Barbara Mokas was actually Barbara Beagle. And on May 5th, detectives interviewed her directly. Barbara told them that on Friday, April 29th, she and her husband had gone to see the movie Colors at the Warner Theater. Afterward, they briefly stopped at Maxwell's before parking near Stillwell's bookstore. As they walked towards the Underground Railroad, Barbara said they encountered Marsha. She described Marsha as wearing a white shirt and dark pants. Barbara joked and asked where she was headed. According to Barbara, Marsha replied, Maxwell's. Barbara said she responded by saying they were going to the Underground Railroad and then they parted ways.
That's incredibly specific. The movie, the location, the conversation.
It is, which makes you wonder, did Barbara truly see Marsha? Or did she genuinely believe she had? Because if Barbara's account is accurate, then everything investigators thought they knew about April 25th changes completely. As detectives chased down leads, they quickly realized they weren't just investigating a disappearance. They were investigating overlapping social circles. Musicians, business owners, drug users, friends, lovers. People connected to biker clubs. People who distrusted police. Everyone seemed to know Marsha. Everyone seemed to have a story, but nobody had answers. And with every witness interview, the mystery of what happened to Marsha Ferber only grew deeper.
At this point, I don't know what to believe anymore. Did she make it back to Morgantown? Did people actually see her afterwards? Or are investigators chasing shadows?
In court, those are the exact same questions investigators were asking in 1988. Because the deeper they dug, the stranger this case became. When we come back, investigators uncover connections to a motorcycle club, a man known as the Beast. and allegations involving cocaine distribution that push this case into even darker territory.
And just when detectives think they've exhausted every lead, a missing $5,000 changes everything.
Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
At this point in the investigation, detectives were drowning in names, friends, business associates, drug contacts, witnesses, people claiming they had seen Marsha after she disappeared, people insisting they hadn't. And somewhere in the middle of it all, investigators had determined whether any of these people actually had something to do with Marsha's disappearance. One of those names kept resurfacing. Glenn Moore.
The same Glenn Moore people claimed they'd seen Marsha with after she vanished?
That's the one. And investigators weren't done looking into him. Remember, witnesses had reported seeing Marsha riding around Marjorie Gardens with Glenn in a gray Pontiac Trans Am. Well, detectives began trying to verify whether this vehicle even existed. And turns out, it did. Detective Boyce later confirmed that Glenn Moore's girlfriend, Cheryl Haisley, owned a gray 1981 Pontiac Trans Am. And according to investigators, Glenn drove it a lot.
So now you've got a witness statement that at least partially checks out.
Right. The car was real. Glenn had access to it. But that still didn't answer the biggest question. Did anyone actually see Marsha with him? Or were these mistaken sightings? Then investigators uncovered something else. Something that pushed this case into even darker territory. A follow-up with the West Virginia State Police revealed that Glenn Moore was known to be associated with the Magnificent Souls Motorcycle Club. He was reportedly known by the nickname The Beast.
Okay, if I'm listening to this episode for the first time, and you tell me somebody's nickname is The Beast, my ears immediately perk up.
Oh, trust me, I know. And investigators learned there was more. State police advised detectives that Glenn was either known or suspected to be associated with members of the same club who were heavily involved in cocaine distribution.
And suddenly, those concerns Karen had about bikers frequenting the Underground Railroad takes on a whole new meaning.
They do. Now, to be clear, investigators never publicly named Glenn Moore as a suspect in Marsha's disappearance. But they absolutely looked into him, because at this point, they had to look into everyone. You've got alleged drug activity, potential biker connections, unconfirmed sightings, conflicting statements. It became almost impossible to separate fact from rumor.
And that's one of the most frustrating things about this case, because it feels every time investigators got close to something solid, another lead sends them in a completely different direction.
Exactly. It's like putting together a puzzle where half of the pieces belong in another box. By the middle of May 1988, investigators find themselves facing what could only be described as a mishmash of names, dates, false leads, and possible motives. At the same time, they still didn't know one very basic thing. Was Marsha Ferber alive, or was she dead? Coordinated coverage from local television stations, radio stations, and newspapers generated an influx of tips. People called in sightings. People offered theories. People claimed to have information, but none of those leads ultimately panned out. And just when detectives thought this case couldn't get any stranger, another twist emerged. This time, it involved money. On May 23rd, Deborah Hamilton contacted Detective Boyce with information she believed could be incredibly important. According to Deborah, she discovered the checking account used by the Underground Railroad had $5,000 less in it than internal records indicated it should have.
Wait, $5,000? That's not pocket change, especially in 1988.
It really isn't, and that's a significant amount of money. Deborah explained that the account itself was actually in the name of Randy Williams, Marcia's boyfriend and business partner, and vice president of the corporation. Although Marcia typically handled many of the business transactions herself, detectives dug into the financial records, and what they found raised even more questions. They discovered that the missing $5,000 had actually been transferred from the business account into a savings account on April 4th, 1988, 3 weeks before Marcia disappeared.
Okay, that's odd, but maybe there was an explanation?
That's exactly what investigators wanted to know. Detective Boyce obtained a subpoena for the records. And according to those records, Randy had used a counter check to transfer the $5,000 into a saving account he held solely in his name. Then investigators noticed something else. $4,000 had been withdrawn from Randy's savings account on April 27th, 2 days after Marcia was last seen.
Okay, now I'm officially confused, because why move the money? Why withdraw most of it after Marcia disappears? And then what happens to the rest?
Well, it gets even stranger. Records showed that $1,500 had been deposited back into the Underground Railroad account on May 9th.
So let me get this straight. $5,000 gets transferred out. $4,000 gets withdrawn. Then $1,500 gets put back.
That's right. And investigators had the same reaction you're having. Why? Why move the money at all? Why take it out before Marcia disappeared? Why withdraw a large portion afterward? And why put some of it back? Was it innocent? Was it suspicious? Did it have anything to do with Marcia's disappearance? Nobody knew. But detectives knew exactly who they needed to talk to. Next, Randy Williams.
Because whether it was completely innocent or something more, there's no way investigators weren't going to ask questions.
Exactly. And in June of 1988, Randy finally sat down with detectives and gave them his side of the story. When we come back, Randy Williams explains the missing money, opens up about his deteriorating relationship with Marcia, admits to another relationship, and voluntarily agrees to take a polygraph examination.
And honestly, some of his answers raise just as many questions as they answer.
By the beginning of June 1988, investigators had spent weeks chasing tips. They interviewed witnesses, they checked hospitals, they tracked down alleged sightings, followed rumors involving biker clubs and drug activity, and now they had another mystery on their hands, the missing $5,000. At this point, detectives decided it was time to sit down with the man at the center of those financial questions, Randy Williams, Marcia's boyfriend, her business partner, and the vice president of the Underground Railroad.
And honestly, I don't think investigators had a choice. Even if they believed there was an innocent explanation, they had to ask him about it.
Absolutely, because if they didn't, they'd never hear the end of it. On June 1st, 1988, Randy Williams provided detectives with a recorded statement. He explained that he personally owned 20 shares of stock in the Underground Railroad and held the title as vice president of the corporation. Then, investigators asked him about the money. According to Randy, his relationship with Marcia had been deteriorating for quite some time. He said the two had been growing apart. Because of that, he secretly transferred the $5,000 from the business account into his own savings account.
Okay, so what was his reasoning? Because that's still a pretty drastic thing to do.
According to Randy, he wanted leverage. He said he believed the relationship and business partnership were ending, and that he wanted some bargaining power if the time came to sell his portion of the corporation. He later returned $1,500 to cover the monthly mortgage payment on the property.
So from his perspective, this wasn't theft, it was business.
Exactly, at least according to him. Whether investigators believe that explanation entirely, that's another story. Because the timing raised eyebrows. Remember, the original transfer happened 3 weeks before Marcia disappeared. Then $4,000 was withdrawn 2 days after she vanished.
And I think that's the part that's hard for people to ignore, the timing. Even if there was an innocent explanation, the timing does not look great.
It doesn't, and detectives knew that. Randy also spoke openly about his relationship with Marcia. He admitted that things hadn't been good. In fact, he acknowledged that part of the strain stemmed from his involvement with another woman.
So not only was their business relationship falling apart, their romantic relationship was too?
Exactly. And if you're investigators, that's another thing you have to consider. Financial disputes, romantic problems, business disagreements. Those are all things detectives routinely look at in missing persons cases. But Randy insisted that despite those issues, he had nothing to do with Marcia's disappearance. He told investigators the last time he had seen Marcia was around 3:30 a.m. on Sunday, April 24th. The same brief encounter outside the Underground Railroad that we talked about earlier. According to him, he had no idea where she was or what happened to her. Randy also described Marcia in a way that some people found surprising. He referred to her as a very jealous woman.
And I think listeners will probably have a mixed reaction to that because that's one person's perception.
Exactly. At the end of the day, it's Randy's opinion. Other people describe Marcia as generous, compassionate, motherly, protective, strong-willed, and complex. The reality is that everyone experiences people differently. But what mattered most to investigators wasn't necessarily how Randy described Marcia. It was whether his story held up. And then Randy did something that surprised a lot of people. He voluntarily agreed to submit a polygraph examination.
Now, before we go any further, let's say what we always say. Polygraphs aren't foolproof. They're not admissible in court in many situations, and they don't prove guilt or innocence.
Exactly. They're investigative tools. Nothing more, nothing less. But the fact Randy agreed to take one was noted by investigators, and eventually, Deborah Hamilton declined to pursue charges against him regarding the misuse of the business funds. That chapter of the investigation appeared to come to a close, but investigators still had another person they needed answers from, Gary Perkins. Because while Randy had spoken to detectives, Gary's story still contained some unanswered questions. And soon, investigators would have an opportunity to sit down with him face to face, because Gary Perkins had troubles of his own. On June 10th, 1988, Gary Perkins was arrested by the Geauga County Sheriff's Department in Ohio. The charge? Receiving stolen property.
Which meant investigators suddenly had another hurdle to overcome.
Exactly, because Gary retained legal counsel, and that delayed any substantial interview regarding Marcia's disappearance. Weeks turned into months, and investigators waited. Finally, on Friday, August 5th, 1988, they got their chance. And what Gary told them would both reinforce part of the timeline and introduce entirely new questions.
Because just when you think you figured out where Marsha's story ends, somebody adds another piece to the puzzle.
And unfortunately, Court, that's become the theme of this entire case. Every answer seems to create two more questions. When we come back, Gary Perkins sits down with investigators months after Marsha vanished, reveals how he first met Marsha, repeats his version of their final day together, and introduces one detail that investigators had never heard before, a detail involving someone Marsha may have been waiting for at the Sheraton.
And after that, we're going to do something we've never really done before. We're going to reconstruct Marsha Ferber's final known moments minute by minute.
Because maybe, just maybe, the answer had been hiding in this timeline all along.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
By August of 1988, Marsha Ferber had been missing for more than 3 months. Investigators had interviewed friends, tracked down witnesses, looked into biker connections, examined financial records, and followed up on countless tips. But despite all of that work, they still didn't know one important thing. What happened after Marsha walked out of the Underground Railroad on April 25th? One of the people who potentially held that answer was Gary Perkins. And after months of waiting, detectives finally got the chance to sit down with him.
Because the first time investigators spoke with Gary, it was over the phone. This was their opportunity to really dig into his story.
Exactly. And on May 5th, 1988, Gary Perkins gave investigators a more detailed interview. And while much of what he said was consistent with what he'd previously reported, there was still some interesting details. Gary told investigators that he and Marsha had first met back in 1978. And honestly, the setting surprised me. According to Gary, he met Marsha while he was incarcerated at the Kennedy Center Federal Corrections Institution in Morgantown.
Definitely wasn't expecting that.
Neither was I. But apparently, the two formed a friendship that lasted nearly a decade. And by 1988, Gary was someone Marsha trusted enough to allow him to stay with her in her apartment, travel with him, and discuss major life decisions. During the interview, Gary largely restated the timeline he already given to investigators. He said he arrived in Morgantown on Sunday, April 24th. He and Marsha discussed Florida. He talked about possible business opportunities. He stayed overnight on her couch. The next morning, they had breakfast, spent time at the Underground Railroad, then they left. He maintained that they stopped at Marjorie Gardens before driving to the Four Point Sheraton near Pittsburgh. After dinner, he said they returned to Morgantown, stopped for gas on Beechhurst Avenue, and then dropped Marsha off at the Underground Railroad. Then he drove back to Morgantown.
So, even months later, his overall story never really changes.
No, and that's worth noting. The broad stroke remained consistent, But then Gary added something investigators either hadn't heard before or hadn't fully appreciated the significance of. Gary told detectives that it was his understanding that Marsha was supposed to be waiting for somebody at the Four Points Sheraton.
Wait, what? Somebody? Who?
That's exactly the question, because Gary didn't identify who that person was. Investigators never publicly identified anyone meeting Marsha at the hotel. And as far as we know, nobody ever came forward.
That changes everything. Because up until now, the trip to Pittsburgh almost sounds casual. Lunch, business talk, a drive back home. But if Marsha was actually expecting someone, now you've got another unknown person entering the timeline.
Right. Was this person connected to Florida? Was it related to business, drug, the Metropolitan Theater? Did the meeting actually happen? Or was it simply something Gary misunderstood? We don't know. But now what we do know is that investigators have now identified what some people refer to as the murder triangle. By this point, investigators have thoroughly examined three individuals whose names repeatedly surfaced throughout the case. Randy Williams, the longtime boyfriend and business partner. Gary Perkins, the last confirmed person to spend significant time with Marsha. And Glenn Moore, the main witnesses claimed they had seen Marsha with after she supposedly disappeared.
And all three of them brought different questions to the table.
That's right. Randy brought financial questions, the failing relationship, the missing money. Gary brought the Pittsburgh timeline, the unverified return trip, and now this mysterious person Marsha may have been waiting for. Glenn brought the alleged sightings, the Trans Am, the biker connections, and the nickname, the Beast.
And none of them gave investigators the one thing they desperately needed. Proof.
You're right. No physical evidence, no body, no confession, no eyewitness to violence, no defiant suspect. Just three men whose names continued to orbit around Marsha's disappearance. In court, I think that's what makes this case so haunting. Because despite all of these leads, investigators still couldn't answer the most basic question. Where was Marsha Ferber? Rumors spread throughout Morgantown. People speculated. Theories multiplied. Some believed that she had been murdered. Others thought she had voluntarily disappeared. Some even believed that she was alive somewhere. But speculation wasn't evidence. And after months of the investigation, detectives were no closer to knowing what had happened than they had been when Jack Herbert first reported her missing.
Which honestly has to be one of the most frustrating parts of this case, because it feels like investigators did everything they could, but every road just led to another dead end.
Exactly, and maybe that's why people are still talking about Marsha Ferber all these years later. Because nobody likes unanswered questions. And this case is full of them. But before we wrap this story up, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to go back to the beginning and reconstruct Marsha Ferber's final known movements. Minute by minute, because sometimes when you stop looking at theories and focus only on facts, you notice things might have been missed the first time around.
So basically, we're taking everything we know and laying it out on the table.
That's right, because maybe the answer to what happened to Marsha Ferber has been hidden in this timeline all along. When we come back, Court and I reconstruct Marsha Ferber's final days, from Saturday night through Monday evening, and examine the timeline that has puzzled investigators for nearly four decades.
And by the end of it, you'll have to decide for yourself, did Marsha ever make it back to Morgantown?
All right, Court, are you ready to reconstruct this case in as much detail as possible?
I think so. Although, after everything we've covered so far, I don't know if I'm more confused or more convinced that the answer is hiding somewhere in this timeline.
Honestly, same. Because sometimes, when you're investigating a case like this, you get so caught up in theories and rumors that you lose sight of facts. So let's strip everything away. No speculation, no assumptions, just what we know. Sadly, we don't know much about Marsha's movements during the first three quarters of Saturday. At some point that day, Marsha spoke on the phone with her friend, Deborah Hamilton. Do we know how long they talked? No. Do we know exactly what they discussed? No. But we do know the conversation happened, and unfortunately, that's all we know.
Which is frustrating, because if we knew what they talked about, it could potentially answer a lot of questions.
Exactly. Especially knowing Deborah would later become one of the people most involved in trying to find out what happened to Marsha. But later that evening, things become much clearer. Around 10:30 p.m., Marsha met with her tenant, Jack Herbert. But I really think it's important to point out again, Marsha wasn't charging Jack rent. She was letting him live there for free.
Which sounds exactly like everything everyone said about her. She genuinely wanted to help people.
She did. Jack told Marsha he was heading to New York City the next day and asked if she'd be willing to watch his booth at a local flea market while he was gone. She agreed. Again, that's a future commitment. Another indication that Marsha expected to be around. Sometime after speaking with Jack, Marsha drove to Purse Glove Road, roughly 4.5 miles northwest of Morgantown. There, she visited her friend, Dana Dalton, at the home Dana shared with her boyfriend. Dana later reported that Marsha simply wanted to get out of Morgantown for a little while.
Nothing unusual, no concerns, no mention of being scared.
None that we know of, no dramatic revelations, no indication she believed she was in danger. Just a visit between friends. Marsha stayed with Dana into the early morning hours before eventually returning home to her apartment above the dry house. According to Randy Williams, he briefly encountered Marsha but around 3:30 a.m. The two exchanged a few words outside, according to Randy. And according to Randy, nothing seemed out of the ordinary.
And this is Randy's last confirmed interaction with Marsha.
It is. By all accounts, later that day, Marsha followed through with her promise to Jack and worked his flea market booth. Again, normal behavior. She was doing exactly what she told people she planned to do. Then sometime before Sunday evening, Gary Perkins contacted Marsha. He confirmed that he would be driving from Cleveland, Ohio to Morgantown. The trip would have taken approximately 3.5 hours. According to Gary, when he arrived in Morgantown, he went directly to Marsha's apartment. The two spent the evening talking. They discussed Florida. They talked about possible business opportunities. And then the two discussed Marsha's growing interest in purchasing Morgantown's Metropolitan Theater.
Which, once again, leaves us with that contradiction. Florida or Morgantown, leave or stay?
Exactly. And even in what may have been her final full day alive, Marsha still seemed caught between those two possibilities. Gary said he spent Sunday night sleeping on Marsha's couch. According to Gary, he woke up Monday morning and had breakfast at the Blue Ribbon restaurant next to the Underground Railroad. After, he joined Marsha in her office. He recalled other people being there. Michelle Wolford later confirmed Gary's presence. Michelle said Marsha told her she planned to take the afternoon off. She expected to return around 6 o'clock that evening. Then, she intended to visit friends. Michelle remembered Marsha wearing her hand-painted white shirt, blue or black jeans, white sneakers, and carrying only a simple day pack.
Again, no luggage, no indication she was disappearing voluntarily.
None. Michelle recalled Marcia and Gary leaving the Underground Railroad sometime between 1 and 1:30 p.m. Gary placed their departure a little earlier around noon. According to Gary, they then drove to Marjorie Gardens, only a couple miles away, a drive that should have taken no more than 5 to 10 minutes. But here's the problem. Nobody knows why they went there, or who they were seeing. Michelle had previously mentioned Shauna Jennings lived there. Another investigative note referenced someone named Becky Payne. But investigators were never able to establish exactly who Marcia may have visited.
Which means one of the biggest questions in this case still has no answer. Why Marjorie Gardens?
And that's a good one. Then according to Gary, they left Morgantown and headed towards Pennsylvania. Their destination was the Four Point Sheraton near Pittsburgh. Under ideal conditions, the drive would have taken approximately 90 minutes. The hotel's manager later recalled a couple matching their descriptions dining there. Then investigators found the receipt. One person ordered a New York strip steak. The other ordered chicken parmesan. Wine was served. The final bill, $75.01. Their waiter, James Terwheeler, later remembered serving them. He said Gary seemed spaced out and Marcia appeared to be tired. He also recalled that the couple remained at the restaurant from 3:27 p.m. to 4:58 p.m.
And that's important because this is our final confirmed sighting. Not a rumor, not speculation, confirmed.
Exactly. As of 4:58 p.m. on April 25th, 1988, we know Marcia Ferber was alive. We know where she was and who she was with. Gary said they then left the Sheraton, headed back to Morgantown. He said they stopped for gas at Beechhurst Avenue, then dropped Marcia off at the Underground Railroad between 6:30 and 7 p.m.
But here's where their timeline starts falling apart because investigators couldn't confirm any of that.
Exactly. No witnesses remembered seeing Marcia back in Morgantown. No phone calls, no receipts, no interactions, nothing. And here's another problem. April 25th, 1988 was a Monday. They left the Sheraton restaurant at 4:58 p.m., right around rush hour traffic. Under perfect conditions, the trip back would have taken 90 minutes. Could Gary have made it back by 6:30? Maybe. Could traffic have delayed them? Absolutely. Could he have arrived closer to 7? Possibly. But investigators noted they had no independent witnesses to corroborate Gary's account, which means everything after 4:58 p.m. depends entirely on Gary's word.
And that's honestly terrifying because if Gary's account isn't accurate, then nobody knows where Marcia Ferber spent her final hours.
Exactly. If Gary's telling the truth, Marcia made it home. If he isn't, then the Sheraton becomes the place where Marcia Ferber was last seen alive. And 38 years later, we still don't know which version of events is true.
You know, Mark, when you lay it all out like this, it doesn't necessarily point you towards an answer, but it does show just how small the window really is.
It does. A matter of hours, a handful of people, a few miles. And somewhere in that timeline, a woman who meant so much to so many people vanished. You know, Court, one of the things that struck me the most while researching this case is that even after nearly four decades, people still talk about Marcia Ferber. Not just because she disappeared, but because of who she was.
And I think that's what separates this case from a lot of others. People aren't just remembering how Marcia's story ended. They're remembering how she lived.
Exactly, because for a lot of people in Morgantown, Marcia represented acceptance. She opened doors, literally and figuratively. She created spaces where people felt welcomed. She supported local musicians. She encouraged young people. She helped people who needed help. Sometimes gave people jobs. Sometimes gave them a place to stay. Sometimes she just listened. And over the years, those small acts of kindness became part of the reason people refused to let her be forgotten. 38 years later, we still don't know. Was Marcia murdered? Did someone she trusted betray her? Did she meet someone in Pittsburgh? Did she make it back to Morgantown? Were the sightings after April 25th legitimate? Or were they simply people trying to make sense of a tragedy?
And I think that's what's so frustrating about this case is that there are so many theories that almost make sense, but none of them completely fit.
Exactly. You can build an argument around Gary, then something doesn't add up. You can look at Glenn Moore and the alleged sightings, then those fall apart. You can question Randy and the missing money, then you realize there's no evidence tracing him to Marcia's disappearance. Every road eventually leads to another unanswered question. Back in 1989, the Underground Railroad property was sold. Some of its original furnishings were salvaged and kept as mementos. Pieces of a place that had once been at the center of Morgantown's alternative culture. A place where music played late into the night, where people gathered, where friendships formed, and where one woman built something bigger than herself.
And for people who were there, those memories never really disappear.
They don't, because while buildings change, the impact people have on others doesn't. In June of 2022, Karen Zellermeyer and her daughter Jamie launched the podcast I Was Never There. And honestly, Court, I cannot say enough good things about it.
Same. And the reason it hits so hard is because this wasn't just another case to them. Karen was Marcia's friend. Jamie grew up knowing Marcia. They weren't researching a stranger. They were trying to understand what happened to someone they loved.
Exactly. The way they approached the story over 8 episodes was incredible. You can hear the heart behind it. You can hear their grief. You can hear their determination to keep asking questions. Because even after all these years, they're still searching for answers. And that's where we find ourselves today. With more questions than answers, a woman who seemed to touch nearly every corner of Morgantown, a timeline filled with contradictions, witnesses' sightings that may or may not have happened, a mysterious trip to Pittsburgh, missing money, rumors, leads that went nowhere, and a disappearance that remains unsolved. But I think it's important to remember something. Marcia Ferber was more than a mystery. She wasn't just a missing persons case. She wasn't a headline. She wasn't a police report. She was a mother, a friend, a business owner, and a humanitarian. Someone who made people feel welcomed. Someone who made people feel special. And someone whose absence left a hole in the lives of people who loved her.
I think that's what I keep coming back to. Somebody out there knows what happened. Maybe it's someone who thought their piece of information was important. Maybe it's somebody who's been carrying this for decades, but somebody knows something.
And while we still don't have an answer as to what happened to Marcia Ferber, that doesn't mean we're done asking what happened to her. Because every time her story is told, someone new hears her name. Someone remembers something. Someone decides to speak up. And maybe one day, that will be enough. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Marcia Ferber, the Morgantown Police Department at 304-284-7475. No matter how insignificant you think your information may be, it may be the missing piece someone has been searching for since 1988. We'll be back next week with a new case. Thank you all so much for listening to Mountain State Mysteries. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to follow us everywhere you listen to podcasts. Leave a review and share this episode with someone who loves true crime and unsolved mysteries.
You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, all by searching Mountain State Mysteries.
Until next time,
stay safe.
And remember, sometimes the smallest detail can solve the biggest mystery.